three, four.
One, two, three, four.
Little Jack five. Horner.
Little Jack Horner.
I think maybe if we started with you just explaining how Point Hope looked when you were little.
When I became aware of where I was, it was Point Hope, of course, where I was born. And one of the first things I experienced was that it was pretty cold. And some people would say that an Eskimo who was born in such a village, like in far northwestern village of Point Hope, that he would be immune to cold, but that's not true. When you're born, you know, you're very cold. You get very cold when the weather is really cold and windy.
What month were you born?
I was born in August, 10th of August, 1911.
How does the weather end up about August up there?
August, in August, around the middle of August, the smell of fall begins to float around in the atmosphere, and we know then that the winter would be coming along, and lots of times snow begins to fall, and then each day got a little colder and colder until the winter sets in.
When do you remember the first ice usually comes?
Well,
on the freshwater.
On the freshwater? Freshwater ice. In November. October and November. But around November it's thick enough for people to travel on it. Like going up to Kuk-Puk River, the grayling fishing grounds from about 35 river miles from Point Hope.
Tell
and that's
me.
Where the people fish every fall around November, around the first part of November.
You once described Point Hope as being really a place of a lot of bounty. Could you tell me how it's set and what it has?
Well, Point Hope seems to be an ideal place for people to settle. And one reason was the animal system, the way they migrated and the way they, one kind of animal or some kinds of animal would migrate 1 month, and about a month later some other species would start migrating, like in spring, around whaling time, around in April, white whales start coming up, and then they precede the big bowhead whales that come that people of Point Hope hunt around the middle of April, starting middle of April. And while that's going on, a few Ugruks would start showing up. And at about the time when the whaling season is over, they come more and more. More and more of them appear. And then after a while, while the ice is breaking up in springtime, there are quite a few Ugruks. And of course, seals are there pretty much all the time, much of the year round. And before the whaling season comes around in April, sometime in March, great schools of tomcod come by, and that's when the people begin to fish for them, and And in the old days, they fished with lines made out of baleen. And this baleen is wound around a wooden
cod, like a cod. Like,
yeah. And it has the things in there where I don't know what you call them. Anyway, they wind them in there. And then each hook, each line has four sets of hooks with a sinker in the center, and then these four small hooks branch out from this sinker, and then you make a hole in the ice and put the hook through it and start fishing, and as soon as you sink your hooks, you catch almost a lot of times on all four hooks there's a little tomcat.
And
sometimes some of them get gaffed on the sinker hooks.
How big are the tomcats?
Tomcod would be about 8 inches to, big ones are probably around 11 inches maybe.
Can you stop just motion? You get the eider ducks in the springtime too after that.
Oh yes, as ice begins to break up in spring, even during the latter part of the whaling season in May, they begin to, the eider ducks begin to migrate up north in great flocks. And in the old days, they hunted them with the bolo type slings. And you get up on the ice hummocks, high ice hummocks along the shore, and hide behind some ice, ice that sticks out. And then as the flock of eiders flew over, you threw this thing at them.
Did you ever try?
I've tried. I remember catching two eider ducks when I was around 11 or 12 years old.
Gosh, I'd be so excited. I don't know what to do.
And the way these bolos, or whatever you call them, act is that when you hit a duck, eider duck, it tangles with its wings and neck and all that and drops it. And then you run over and get the duck.
Was the thing made out of sinew, the strings?
Yeah, the strings were usually made out of sinew, and sometimes with a real fine, thin seal thongs. And the old timers used bones and ivory for the weights on the end of the strings. And the grip is made out of duck feathers, wing feathers.
The whole wing or the?
No.
Just the feathers?
They're just bound on the bottom, attached to these strings, these four or five strings. And you take a hold of it, the thing is supposed to be about so long, and then you swing the thing around your head and throw them.
A little less than a yard, probably.
Yeah, something like that. About 28 inches or something like that.
And after the, you get the seals all through the year. And after the ice goes out, what can you hunt then?
After the ice goes out and broken up, walrus start coming. And that's after the Ugruks, the bearded seal, became a little, you know, numbers decrease as time goes on. And then the walrus comes in. They begin to migrate north towards around the Round Point up towards Barrow.
And a walrus, I can't imagine how they killed those in the old days before they had guns. They must weigh 5,000 pounds.
Yes, some of them weigh a couple of tons.
How did they ever get them and drag them?
You know, I don't know either, but they got them. They used harpoons to get them in the old days.
Would a float hold them up? Would they put a float on them?
Yeah, well, they that's what they did.
Or do they try to get them on the ice if they can? Of course.
No, they have to kill them in the water.
They do.
And, of course, in my time, when I was growing up, I used to go with my father and hunt walrus in spring like there was, well, as the ice has, you know, broken up and loose and floating around. And when the walrus is migrating, they like to get up on large cakes of ice and sun themselves and sleep and rest or something, and that's when my father, myself, and other men at Point Hope begin to hunt these big animals. And we sneaked up to them from the sun side, you know, because they can't see against the sun. And then when we got close to them very quietly in a skin boat or umia, well, my father would begin shooting. And I remember once he got three of them before the rest of them dove into the water. It was a good shot.
It must have been pretty fast, because once one of them is startled, they all start lumbering off the... How would you ever drag them home? They put the floats on them and then just all the men?
No, the smaller ones we put in the umia, in the skin boat. And others we have to cut up because they're too big, too dangerous. You might tip the boat over, you know. You have to cut them up and in large pieces where a man can handle them.
They use all the walrus. Can they eat it
all?
Oh,
yes. They use pretty much all of it, and including the flippers, front flippers and back flippers.
That's the best part, isn't it?
Yes, and they like to cure those into, cure them in oil, in its own oil. And after a while, they get a little smelly, but that's the way they like them. They're cured, and after the fat in them is rendered, well, that's after they get to smell a little bit, that's when they like them best. But of course, you can eat them fresh and cook them. And boil them, and the longer you boil them, the more tender they get, and they're pretty good that way too.
And you use all the seal, and you use the inside of the seal for
seals. We have used the intestines, boil them and eat them, and liver, of course, is very good.
My favorite food.
Yeah. And of course, the meat. And there's always a choice part in any animals, and the choice part on the seal is the thigh parts of the seal and brisket. Mm. Those are the choice parts of the seal. And of course, they use the rest of it, they eat all of it, in fact. And it's used for dog food a lot of times also.
Did your mother render the oil?
Yes,
how did she
made
do
it
that?
Made it into seal oil. She takes inflated seal skins or pokes, and which have been dried and prepared for such a thing, and cuts up the seal blubber, which is about inch and a quarter to inch and a half thick in some places, the thickest part of it. And she cuts them into slices about 4 inches and about 2 inches, 2 by 4 inches or something like that. And then puts them in this seal poke. And then you put the seal, this poke, after it's all filled with seal blubber, in the hallway of the igloo or wherever you lived, you know. And after a while it begins to render inside this poke, and that's curing again, you know. And some time, well, when the oil is pretty much thoroughly rendered from the blubber, well, it's about ready for consumption.
How long does it take?
It takes, I don't remember, it takes probably about 3 weeks or so.
And then you
They kept it sometimes in a warmer place than you know, than the hallway. And then after it renders, well, when it gets the right taste to it, well, they put it where it's cool. And that's to keep it from spoiling, from getting rancid or something like that. And when you draw, when you drew seal oil from the seal poke, would be usually in winter, and we'd have it in the hallway out from the igloo. And then you get some of that oil into a pan or something. And after that, well, you take the oil out of it, I mean the air out of the poke, because they want you to take the air out, so they and then tie it up as tight as you can, so no air gets back in there. And in that way, you can keep it from getting rancid and for a long, long period. And you know, it should be kept cold all the time after it's ready for, after it's rendered.
What about the other animals that come in the summertime? There's regular fishing. What can you get for regular fish?
Well, we get whitefish and salmon and Arctic char and some herring and smelt, little fish, and some lakes.
They net them?
They net them.
And they get caribou down there in the
Caribou usually stays around pretty much throughout the winter and summer, but some winters it doesn't stay around too much, because there's sometimes there's a scarcity of caribou meat, or you know, like it was this year at Point Hope, they didn't get any caribou for a long time until just recently.
How big a population are we talking about for Point Hope when you were little? Do you have any idea?
There was about 300 to 325, somewhere in there.
Were there any times that you can remember when it was really bad hunting all year round, or did things pretty much even out?
There was some periods during the winter when hunting conditions were very bad, and hunters would go out every day but brought nothing back, because on account of unfavorable hunting conditions.
But you'd have an ice cache where your family would put things from the other season.
Yeah, they have what they call slugs. Underground caches dug into the permafrost. And where you can keep meat, even frozen. Demon stays frozen during the summer when the sun is shining. Nice, kind of warm sometimes, you know. But in these underground caches, the meat stays frozen and cures at the same time.
Were they usually, was the icebox usually fairly full, or did the people of Point Hope usually have some sort of backlog of food for those bad seasons?
These caches were made for such things as storing food. They can store a lot of meat in there.
They have
different levels, like the top part would be for Ugruk or walrus meat, where they store it and cure it, sort of cure you like filet mignon or something, you know. The older the meat, the better it is their idea. And at the lowest part of the cache, in a certain special chamber, is the whale meat and muktuk stored way down below the Ugruk and walrus meats.
Would it all be frozen, or would the top part just be cold and the bottom part would be frozen?
The bottom part would be pretty much frozen. That's where the whale meat and muktuk is, you see. And on the top level, on the platform sort of a thing, the Ugruk meats, like mother used to prepare them for storage by lacing them into sort of a ball with a blubber side outside, and then they're putting that round ball of Ugruk meat down on this platform, and after a while they sort of cure. And
what would you tie them up with? This
with old thongs or something like that.
Can you remember any times when your ice cellar was bare?
Was what?
Bare, empty, when you didn't have
it got a little pretty empty sometimes, especially when the village didn't get too many whales. Once some springs, maybe one or two. And that's when by the time the next whaling season comes around, most of the caches would be quite empty. And of course, the men keep hunting in some ways. Although I remembered some some shortages of food in the village. It never got really serious, although mother had to ration some meat for us every once in a while. And then by that time, my father or somebody else, some other hunter, would get some seals and brought him back. And that's when one time I remember that father came back from hunting and he brought two seals. And that, it was a period of one of those things, you know, where hunting conditions were bad and food supplies got low. And mother would, after they thaw it out in the house, you know, she'd start cutting them, and these two seals, and then she'd cut pieces of loin or ribs or something like that, and she'd cut those and then ask me and my sister and my brother to take a certain piece to a certain family. My mother would say, bring this to your aunt and bring this to your cousin or somebody else, to some old people. Things like that, and until the mother would cut these things out and kept telling us to bring the meat to this family and that family, until we, you know, there was very little left for us. And I used to get kind of perturbed at Mother because I voiced my concern several times. And I told her that, why don't you leave some for us? First thing you know, we won't have too much to eat tomorrow or the next day or the next day. And then Mother would say, well, you just keep your mouth shut. And then next day somebody would knock on our door and they'd come with maybe a piece of caribou or a piece of ugruk or and all that. And in summertime they'd bring a whole salmon, large, nice, big, fresh salmon. These are the things they did all through the ages, apparently.
So you not only helped people out who needed help, but you managed to get a really varied diet because everybody was hunting.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And it was, you know, they had to do it in that manner because when hunting conditions are bad, the whole village suffers, and they had to share. And of course, in plenty of in good times, good hunting periods, well, you know, they can store as much as they want to for themselves, you know.
Yeah. When even though things got tough in Point Hope as compared to other villages like Noatak that didn't have the whales to depend on, Point Hope was probably better off than any village in the area, wasn't it?
It was many times much better off than other villages because of these succession of animals that migrated throughout the year, except in, between after the ice breaks up and floats out, and of course at that time Point Hope is ice free. There's no ice on the shores. It's all melted. And until the ice comes back in November sometime, and then along with it, seals. And
so you have a period when the ice goes out during the summer when there's not too much going on, but you've got the lake fishing then.
Yeah, lake fishing. And once in a while there would be walrus, stragglers, or you know, people that the walrus that apparently travel leisurely or something, they'd come by
lazy
the
walrus
village and get up on the beach. And of course, the hunters hunt them when they do that. And these are nice, welcome things sometimes.
Did you get berries out there?
Oh yes, there are a lot of berries at Point Hope. Well, what we call blackberries and salmon berries. And these are picked in August, early August or somewhere around there.
And you get pushkis, that wild celery, any plants that you eat?
Oh yes, I don't know, we had sourdough, you know, sour leaves. Mother used to let me gather a whole big bunch of them and she'd cook them up.
Are they like spinach?
Yeah. No, they're sour. And then she'd put sugar in the stewing leaves and thicken it with a little flour. And
I had a rhubarb sourdough pie the other day that was the best darn stuff I've ever had up in Buckland.
Buckland?
So it must be something related to, sort of rhubarb in a way then.
Mm-hmm. And then we have certain kinds of roots. We even have roots gathered by mice that we used to look for in fall time or early winter out on the tundra. And that was kind of fun. And Mother and myself and my sister and my younger brother, the four of us would go out on tundra And you know, and Mother would tell us, well, you walk over here, you walk over here, I'll walk here, and you walk over here, you walk over there. And away it would go. And Mother used to tell us, well, if you step on something kind of soft under your foot, be sure and tell me. Be sure and holler and tell me. And, you know, it might be the mouse cache. And sure enough, when we did that, well, I've stepped into several of these things. So Mother would come over and then we look at it, and well, that's it. And then she'd take her ulu, Eskimo woman's knife, you know, and slit the top of it about 6 inches or 7 inches long. And then she'd put her hand down into the cache and take a handful and put them in the sack or sealskin packs, you know, we used a lot. And then we put those roots into this container. And after a while, Mother would say, well, if you ever get these when I'm not around, don't take all the roots. Leave about half of the roots in the cache. Because if you take all of them, this little mouse is going to starve. And he may not be around next year to get us more roots.
You were going to tell me about the polar bears.
Well, the polar bear has always been hunted at Point Hope, and it amazes me how the old timers did it. And they used spears, and when they come up against the polar bear to get it, it was apparently quite tricky, because polar bear is a very powerful animal and can use its front paws, arms, to attack with, along with its big teeth and jaws.
They got a long reach too.
They have a long reach, and they're very adept with their left paw.
Left-handed polar bear.
They're left-handed apparently. And the old timers years ago, before they had the guns, the rifles, used these spears to hunt the polar bear. And they when they come up against the animal, they made the bear attack them, and then they had this long-handled spear, and as the bear lunged, well, they had to aim it around the chest somewhere where it's easier for them to impale it as it lunged toward them. That's the way they used to get them.
They'd have to make him rear up on his hind legs.
Dive forward, and when they did that, well, that's when they attack him with these spears, which must have been very...
You wouldn't have had much of a training period.
And they got him, and of course, some men probably got, a polar bear probably got the better of him and all that, you know, but I've never heard anything like that, but there must have been cases where there were hunters that were killed by the polar bears. Under such circumstances, the polar bear is an angry animal, and it is nothing to fool around with, because they're very fierce when they're wounded and all that.
Did you ever see one killed? Did you ever go?
No, I never have seen one killed in that manner. But during my growing period, they already had carbines, the 30-30s, and this is what they hunted the polar bear with. And they used to get the hunters used to get quite a few during the year, about 75 at least, for the whole village. Until plane hunting by planes began to be developed up there, and of course these hunters kept the polar bears from getting close to the village, and therefore the polar bear take each year was getting less and less. There was a period at Point Hope where they got only two or three a season instead of 75 or so. And now since this year, since the polar bear hunters, plain hunters had been banned from hunting polar bears at Point Hope, the hunters are beginning to get polar bears again. The last time I heard, there were quite a few hunters that had gotten polar bears at Point Hope.
Any particular season when polar bear hunting would be best?
Well, it would be around this time of year, February, March, around there.
Then really you've hit all the seasons. There wouldn't be much of a season where there'd be a break except in the summer when the ice is out.
Yeah, the summertime is it's not only time for fishing or camping. It is also time in the village. It is also time to relax from the vigors of the whole hunting year. The men kind of relax during that time when they don't go up inland to do something.
Did you used to stay up all night like all those kids?
Yeah, I used to. And anyway, I want to say a little more about the summertime thing. That's when the men kind of relax and take like little leisure a little bit. And that's when they begin to repair their umiaks or skin boats, or they make new ones, new frames for the skin boats for the next year for whaling. And that's the period of time that they use to do these things, extra little things that needed to be done for the coming hunting year.
What would you do in the summertime? What did you do when you were little?
Well, summertime, for about 50 days, the sun shines continuously 24 hours a day for 50 days. And that was the time when, as little boys, along with my little friends, we used to ask our parents to stay up all night. And of course, we were told not to get into trouble or get into somebody else's property and doing things like that, you know. And they were very stern about this sort of thing, and we had to promise that we wouldn't do anything like that. So, well, sometimes we managed to convince our parents that, we'd like to stay up all night. And that's what we did.
Did you play games?
We played games, we ran around the beach, and about 2:30 or 3 o'clock, you know, well, we could hardly keep our eyes open. So we just, while the sun is shining down, just flop on the beach, on the gravel, and sleep a while. And, you know, and other things, we played games, and we used our slings, you know, and at the, there are always birds flying, even in summer, usually, especially MERS, or crowbills, as they call them. And we used to have our slings. We never hit anything hardly, but we used to try anyway.
Are there any shellfish up there? Any?
Well, shellfish. We have crabs, but they're tiny. They're tiny crabs. up at Point Hope, but they do get them, and they get these, you know, by the hundreds sometimes.
How do they catch them?
They make nets, a round thing, you know, with a rock in the center as a sinker, and then they cover this and tie and cover this rock, the sinker, with seal meat, and tie that on to, you know, tie that on tightly onto the sinker, and then lower this thing down to the bottom of the sea, bottom of the Chukchi Sea, and these little crabs apparently flock to it, and after a while, you know, you pull this thing up, and it's all piled up with these tiny crabs. And then you do that several more times, and you get a sack full of them, and go home.
Do you eat them raw?
Yes, they ate them raw, frozen, and the legs and certain parts of the body of the crab.
I know, looking at the Eskimo dictionary, the names of the months are usually translate to terms about game and or weather. Can you remember any of them that might?
Well, I don't remember too much about about that. Oh, I'm sorry.
I know one of them is the season when the eider ducks come back, and then there's one when it's called the season when we eat the straps, which must mean that the caches were pretty much empty. And people get kind of hungry. Could you tell me what kind of houses people lived in when you first remember? Were they living in sod houses then?
Yeah, most of the villagers at Point Hope were living in sod houses. And, of course, during that time, we started going to school, and some of our villagers started building frame houses. And of course, we were made to believe that that was a type of house in which to live.
Weren't the frame houses colder?
And they were colder, and when some of us, like my aunt, my uncle, and of course we lived inside an igloo, which was very warm and comfortable, and even in dead of winter. And there was such a feeling that instilled in some of us that these frame houses were the type of houses to live in, because the igloo was considered as primitive and all that, you know, even though it was warmer, much warmer than the frame houses they were building, started to build at that time, and when they moved in, they were cold, but they were living as modern Eskimos, I guess.
Could you describe the sod houses for me? How people made them and how they looked?
Prepare a sod house, you must have a supply of spruce driftwood, and a year before you build it, you cut up blocks of sod about 4 or 5 inches thick and about a foot square, and you pile these in a bricklaying fashion, so into the weather, so the weather will dry them for next year's igloo, a new igloo, sod igloo, and during the spring after whaling, the men begin to shape the frame of the igloo out of driftwood. And they hew out the flooring for it by what do you call that? Adze or something, and use that for flooring. And then they use more planks for the walls. And then they make sort of a domed roof for it.
How big was the thing be?
Well, some of them were much larger than my office here, but some were larger than that. And it depends on the size of the family a lot of times. They weren't built too big because to conserve heat is what they, you know, although they were easy to heat, you know, the old time people used nothing but seal oil or whale oil lamps. Two of those in an average size hot igloo would heat the place up very, very nicely.
What would they use for cooking in the olden days?
In the olden days, they cook outside the main room and out in the hallway. There's little side rooms with an open top on it, and which is covered when it's not in use. And they build a fire there, and the women do their cooking over an open fire.
Wood fire?
Wood fire. Fed with, to make it last, fed with strips of seal blubber.
There's no better fuel in the world. What were they using to heat when you were little? Were they still using seal oil?
Yeah, we used in our igloo, Mamanginyar's and Nayakuk's igloo well, we used, there was a little stove in the, you know, they began to build little stoves out of drums, gasoline drums, and they rivet them together, put an oven in it, and the firebox and stove pipe. By that time they were getting stove pipes, you know, they could buy.
So that's what you started in with. You
well,
missed
yeah.
the seal oil.
Mm-hmm. But
lamp.
We still used seal oil at our igloo, and it.
And it would provide light too.
Yeah, provide light.
Could you read by it, Paul?
Oh yes, you can read by it. Now you can make the flame in larger whale oil lamps. You know, you can make a flame about a foot and a half, long. You know, but
depending on the wick.
Yeah.
What did they use for a wick?
They used dried moss, a certain kind of moss, dried and powdered. And I used to tend those things. It was kind of fun.
You have to pay attention, though, don't you?
Oh yes. If you're good, you know, you do it in such a way that it doesn't smoke.
Were you good?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
And what would you have for eating utensils? Had they collected a batch of dishes by that time, or did they have homemade ones?
Yes, collected dishes, mostly porcelain type dishes, you know, tin or metal covered with porcelain. These were the types of dishes, cups, and of course spoons and forks and knives.
Did you have enough?
We never
for
used the forks and knives too much because the spoon was the only thing that was used mostly, because mother and other women made duck soups and seal soups and things like that.
What's your favorite food? What was your favorite food when you were a kid?
Well, of course, the whale meat, whale muktuk and meat was universal favorite of the Eskimos in the whaling community, like Point Hope. And that was my main, my favorite. And of course, caribou was about the next one, I believe. And of course, ugruk and changes, they change, diets. I mean, different meats.
Yeah.
And which was enjoyable. And and very satisfying to me, and it was apparently to all of them there.
When the white man's food came along, what was the thing you liked best?
Well, one of the things I liked best, of course, was homemade bread. My mother learned how to make bread, and she was very good. And of course, butter was my favorite. And condensed milk also was around, which we liked very well. And peaches and tomatoes, canned tomatoes, and
was there a store
canned
up
peaches.
There?
What?
Was there a store up there?
Well, yes, there was a store where they sold flour and rice and beans and rolled oats and all that sort of stuff.
Was it a local trader? Or?
Yes, there was a local trader, Eskimo. Peter Kuniak was his name, and he had a store he was running for a long time when I was young.
Any candy bars in that day and age?
Yeah, they had mostly hard candy, and later on they began to sell candy bars.
And that's when Jake Jacobson started making his money. Got heat and light. Oh, clothing. What kind of clothing?
Well, clothing, of course, was a main thing for the people in order to survive the winters, and this was usually made from inexpensive as possible materials like caribou skins or reindeer skins. They did have a herd at one time, reindeer herd at Point Hope, and these were ideal for winter clothing, although they last about a year. And because the hair is not too stable, it breaks easily and all that. And when you're a hard-working man, well, the hair kind of wears off, and then they have to make a new one. The women make new parkas for next year. I mean, when the year another winter comes around. And these were very, very light, and they were tanned by the women into a very supple, soft, they were very supple, and you felt free as you were, and they were light.
Was the fur on
and
the
they
inside?
They were warm.
Fur on the inside for the working buffers?
They used fawn skins. For the inside pockets, or squirrel skins for inside pockets. And the two layers of parkas, and then later on, when I was growing up, they covered these with white calico cover, and which of course was apparently they used to camouflage themselves when they're hunting. They kind of blended with the ice, and which later on was borrowed by the U.S. Army and Russian Army during the Second World War.
They borrowed quite a few things,
yes.
Didn't they? The idea of your mukluks is also...
Yeah, mukluks and of course the parka is being used a great deal by the Army nowadays in up north here, and where it's cold.
And the principle of the mukluk would be the airspace.
Airspace, and your footwear should not be too tight. Always, there should always be space for air.
Did you use caribou socks, caribou fur socks? Or?
Caribou socks, yes.
And then did you put moss inside the mukluk?
No, not moss, but my parents used to let me gather dried roots, grass roots or plant roots from by the seashore. They're exposed and dry, and I gather those. And,
the kind that creep along the beach?
No, they're exposed by the wave action, you see. And they dry up. And these are the best kind of insoles you can have, and because the little roots are a little hollow, you know, there's a little hole in them, and they're resilient, you know, and when you step on them, they press down, and when you step up, well, like, they kind of come up, you know, and. And these were the best kind of insoles, and they didn't slip. You know, they didn't travel into your feet. They didn't slip, and they were the best kind of insoles that you could have because they they're stationary and they're warm and they keep the air circulating. And but it's very character the little roots with the little holes in them. You know, little tubes.
What would people wear under everything? Did Long John's, had Long John snuck up to Point Hope by the time
well,
he came
yeah,
along?
They had snuck up when I was growing up. But the old timers, when they got home from hunting, they just take, you know, their bear from the waist up.
But those houses were so hot.
Oh, yeah, they were hot.
I couldn't understand till I finally got into Ruth's tent out there on the sea, and they fired up that seal rubber, and geez, you know, you'd want
that
to hear
hot.
You're out on the middle of the Chukchi Sea, and you're just dying of the heat, and the tent.
yeah.
And those seal oil lamps, I finally saw them in Diomede, and just one of them keep this little house in the, you know, it was in the fall time. I used to have one of those.
Yeah.
You were talking about being cold, and I think that would be a good thing to end the day on. Since
what?
About being cold when you were little.
Yes, sometimes mother would be busy, and some of us, especially in larger families, you know, some of us would kind of suffer from lack of footwear. Although she didn't neglect us, you know, she kept mending our little mukluks and.
How many kids did she have to look after?
There was, when I was a child, there was one, two, three, four, five, six of us, seven of us. And of course, my mother's main chore was to clothe my father properly because he was our hunter and all that. And of course, she tried to clothe us as well, you know. But once in a while, our mukluks would tear, and sometimes they get holes in them, and you know, from too much. Activity and all that sort of stuff, and they get cold after a while. And that was a time when you have to be careful that you don't freeze your feet or.
How cold does it get up there? For people who don't know anything about that country, it's hard to explain.
Well, in winter, once in a while, it gets down to 40 or 45 below, along with 20 mile wind or more sometimes, you know, which gets very cold. But if you're properly dressed for, even at that temperature, you can be comfortable. The way of dressing is a very, very important thing in the Arctic areas.
Did you ever get frostbitten?
Oh yes, I've had frost bites on my cheeks and nose and ears, and. Not very often, but I have had frostbites. And my father, I have had frostbites.
You had to walk a long ways to go to school. How far was that?
That was about a mile. And it was kind of tricky some days. During the day, sometimes a blizzard would come up, and by the time by the time it was time to go home, well, the blizzard would be so thick that we couldn't see very far. We used to bunch up together and walk up to the North Beach, and we knew that we'd hit the village after a while, and we knew the certain landmarks, and we'd follow those, and we knew whose igloo was the closest, and whatever child was there, along, well, we'd take him there and take the next one, and then go home.
Did you ever get scared because of the weather?
Well, I don't remember being scared, actually. It was almost a sort of an adventure and a sort of a danger at the same time, I guess. But I never had too much time to get scared. Except maybe at one time when we were playing hooky. I was playing hooky during summertime, and when I fell into the ocean. And no, I didn't fall. It was somebody else, some other boy, fell in, and we threw a line to him, and he grabbed it, and we pulled him out. And you're not careful, things like that can happen to you. And this one we weren't supposed to do. That was during the town when we were staying up all night. And when our parents found out about it, well, it was pretty scary. Yeah, they reprimanded you pretty thoroughly when they found out something like that, that you were risking your life, when there was no grown-ups around.
Did you ever lose any playmates
from
accidents?
No, I never have.
That's amazing to me, the number of years people have been whaling off Point Hope, and I can't think of anything more dangerous. And there's no loss of life up there, is there, since your grandfather?
Yeah, they were very early in life. The children, especially boys, were given pretty thorough indoctrination of how to survive, how to withstand the weather, how to dress, everything like that. And food was important. When your stomach is empty, you get cold very easily. And they always advise that you have a good meal or something before you go hunting, and along the way while you're hunting, you maybe you have a piece of cooked seal meat you can eat on, and even some caribou suet. That'll do it.
Caribou
good for
suet,
you.
That'll do it.
Yeah, that'll do it, and and it'll help you to keep warm, especially when it's cold.
That should do it for that.
Yeah. Sanitation,